Check anyone's list of the most significant inventions of the century or of the millennium, and the atomic bomb will be at the top of the list. Although used only twice, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki nearly 55 years ago, the development and proliferation of increasingly more powerful atomic and then hydrogen bombs raised the prospect that if such weapons were ever used again, they would spell the end of life on Earth as we know it. We became a people obsessed with the bomb, and nowhere is that obsession more visible than in the hundreds of films that constitute what we call the atomic bomb cinema. We have in our studio today an expert on atomic bomb cinema, Jerome Shapiro. Professor Shapiro, an American by birth and education, is currently on the Faculty of Integrated Arts and Sciences, Hiroshima University in Japan, where he serves as resident cinema studies scholar. Welcome, Jerome.
Thank you very much.
Let's start off by basically telling us the origins. Where did atomic bomb cinema begin?
Well, its origins lie in silent films and early films. There's films about radiation as early as 1914. In 1935, there's Phantom Empire, a serial western with Gene Autry. Fritz Lang's Metropolis has also great significance because of its apocalyptic and religious nature, the structure of films, how they worked out in later Hollywood films. So its origins can be looked at there, in along with the rest of cinema history.
Now, this predates the atomic bomb.
Absolutely.
Okay, so how is it atomic?
Well, Fritz Lang's Metropolis is not atomic at all, but what we're seeing is some of the same themes that were developing in Hollywood appear in atomic bomb cinema. So when we talk about film history, how films are made, how the stories are told, and some of the themes, Metropolis is very apocalyptic, rather, which I guess we'll talk about in a minute.
Sure.
But in terms of radiation and atomic, we're looking at some science fiction films, including some early silence. But it disappeared, as most people know, in the 40s when the government asked people to stop talking about things concerned with atomic research.
Why did they do that?
Well, in the 40s, the government undertook the commitment to develop the bomb, and during the wartime, and they then censored very aggressively any discussion of it. But before that, there had been a great deal of discussion about the potential of radioactive material, both in science, in popularized science, and in literature.
Now, it's clear from what you're saying, you take film seriously. It isn't just entertainment, otherwise you wouldn't be examining these films. So you want to talk a bit about that? Why is film important for us as people?
Well, film is our storytelling medium. Much like stained glass windows were in past eras, it's a visual storytelling medium. We process information in many different ways. We mostly think about how we process and criticize and think critically about things through our school training, through our academic training. But we process, that's only one way of processing information and assimilating information, criticizing information. We also process it sort of affectively. What is this experience like? And our scholarly training, our scholarly way of criticizing doesn't always answer those questions. It's not complete. It's hard to use that sort of language to talk about the experience. Stories cover that. Poetry cover that way. Films are very important because they help us understand the experience in a different way than reading a scholarly book, a critical book on the subject. So films are very important for the culture and the individual in terms of understanding important events.
Okay, so if we examine these films over time, even if we look at just the 50-some-odd years we've actually had the atomic bomb, do we have the same themes? Do these themes change? How do they appeal to each era?
You're asking two questions, and there's two answers to that. One, there are certain themes that run through all the majority of films, and there are themes that respond to each period or era that we look at. If we look at The first films about the atomic bomb beginning in 1947 with The Beginning or the End, we see the hopefulness at the end of the war, and also the great concerns. There was, gee, where are we now? But there is this great sense of relief, and a lot of these films prophesize, sort of describe a future paradise, and the beginning of the notion of increasing affluence. We see that there. And by 1945, when the Soviets demonstrate that they can build a bomb too, America feels like they've lost their secret, their monopoly on both the bomb and goodness and affluence. But really, now there's this threat out there, and we see increasing concerns about that. Right after that, in the 50s, we see the thermonuclear weapons developed and used increasingly, and bomb films respond to that. We see bomb films that respond to the social and racial tensions of the 60s. We see bomb films that respond to the declining economic powers of the United States, the moving from abundance to scarcity. And in the 80s, we begin to see a more sophisticated vision. Terminator, for example, sort of sees social systems as well-meaning but incapable. The police want to help the heroine, Sarah, but they can't. And so things fall back on the individual. In the 90s, we see environmental issues moving to the fore. But throughout that, they're all connected, I believe, by one theme, and that is the apocalyptic imagination.
Explain that a bit.
Well, if we look at the apocalyptic imagination, means many things to many people. If we go back to its first real flourishing in the Jewish tradition, which is not necessarily mainstream Jewish tradition at that time, but the apocalyptic narrative storytelling tradition really got developed with the Jews. If we look at those stories, the elements within them, and the purposes they served, we see great similarities to films about the bomb. There is an otherworldly journey. There is a revelation interpreted. There is final judgments. There is an exhortation to be righteous. And similar elements like that. There is also, it has a similar function. The most important function of the apocalyptic imagination is that it's a kind of poetry that, again, helps us understand our current situation through talking about the experience through a kind of poetry, as I said, film does. It's not a scholarly critique. It's a poetic critique that gives us a different perspective, helps us assimilate and understand information differently. This tradition, the focus of this, of the apocalyptic narrative tradition, is to get us, to exhort us, to encourage us to survive and self-actualize under oppressive conditions. The early apocalypses and even the bomb films strongly encourage a spiritual awakening.
Give us an example of that. Take one maybe from the 50s and one from the 60s, if you can, your favorites, if you will.
Okay. Well, if we look at the elements such as the otherworldly journey, the revelation revealed and the revelation interpreted, the exhortation, the time machine is just the quintessential bomb film. We see this man take an otherworldly journey in the future. He really doesn't move very far in space. He doesn't move very far from his home, but he moves in time, and that's an otherworldly journey. There is a revelation revealed. He listens to these rings about history, and eventually he becomes to understand those, and he himself becomes the spiritual being that interprets that. He returns back to his own time. He interprets his revelation. He exhorts his friends to righteousness, but they don't listen to him. So he returns to the future to build a utopia. One thing I left out is that the apocalypse is about rebirth. It's not about death. Again, it exhorts us to survive and self-actualize. So it's about the chance for rebirth.
So there's a note of optimism, are you saying?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Only two films that I can think of, one Japanese and one American, actually end with the end. There is no, the narrative, the story does not continue. Mm-hmm. In terms of the spiritual awakening, you have to look at perhaps 1957, The Incredible Shrinking Man. in which this guy, again, the bomb initiates the story. But it's not just the bomb. And it's about 1950s environment. It's about the organization man. He's a veteran who can't quite fit in. He's then exposed to radiation and insecticide. He begins to shrink. He takes an otherworldly journey, almost a Greek mythic journey. There's the whirlpool and all these different mythological associations. And at the end of the film, he passes through a screen event that creates this pattern of crucifixes. And he enters into the garden, and he has this great awakening, this great understanding of the world and his place in it. And we may not identify it as a particularly Christian or Jewish or any other, or, you know, there's sort of Zen overtones to this, Buddhist overtones to it, but it's a mix. What it's really encouraging us to is have our own spiritual awakening. He has this new mystical understanding, and without that, we can't survive oppressive times.
Now, you brought up Japanese cinema, so let me pursue that. You're living in a city, one of the two cities ever to be victimized by the bomb. How does Japanese cinema differ, or is it much the same in responding to the bomb?
Let's take similarities first. In the Jewish apocalyptic tradition, there is connected, I believe, another Jewish tradition, which is called Tikkun HaOlam, the restoration of a fractured world, a commitment to repair, to restore the world, no matter how futile that task may be. And we see that optimism in films about the bomb. In Japanese films, we see what I call the restoration of balance and harmony. And the idea of balance and harmony with nature, with others, with one's social environment is very strong in Asian cultures, and especially strong in Japan. That's where the notion of consensus comes from. It's more important that everyone agree than that you actually choose the right thing to do. People might agree it's the wrong thing to do, but it's more important that everyone be in consensus to do this thing. So that's one extreme of it. Mm-hmm. We see In films about the bomb, this is often played out in a very complex symbolic role. When we look at Godzilla films, for example, Mothra versus Godzilla, we see that men have become too strong through warfare, and that's an imbalance. Well, it's not just men per se. It is social, it is political, but it's more than that. It's this general notion of the masculine versus the feminine. So women, in often very subtle ways that Westerners do not notice, assert themselves for what would be assertive for a Japanese woman. And they restore balance, they restore harmony. In Mothra versus Godzilla, this is very symbolically played out in symbols rather than the actual human characters. The silkworms encase Godzilla in a cocoon. They put him in a chrysalis. Silk is intimately connected to women's culture. The empress is still the head of the silk culture. As the widow of the director, Mrs. Kimi Honda, pointed out to me, a chrysalis is a kind of womb that transforms things. And Godzilla is masculine. He's an upset, disrupted masculine element that's been reawakened by the bomb. And he must be transformed. He must be quieted. He's often thought of as a sort of a young boy who's been woken out of his sleep and has to be lulled back to sleep because he's upset and he's causing havoc. So he's put in this womb-like chrysalis and then sent back into the ocean where to be transformed, and balance and harmony is restored. And this is also very playful, which people don't understand. Although modern Japanese seem to be very serious, there's a very playful act, very playful level to Japanese culture, which has been hidden since 1868 in the Restoration, this attempt to modernize, suppress the playfulness, which comes out in very serious things like films about the bomb.
I was talking to a few people recently about doing this interview, and they had to stop for a moment to even think whether atomic bomb cinema really still existed. Mm. So, does it still exist? What do we look for? What films would you remind us of?
Oh, absolutely. Living in Japan, films take a little while to get to me. Actually, I can buy a DVD from the U.S. quicker than I can see the film in Japan. But I understand there's been blasts from the past. There's a film called End Time coming out in November. Most recently, Waterworld, 1995. Well, not most recently, but that's a big film that stands out in people's imagination. The American film Godzilla, which was bought from the rights was bought from Japan. So no, absolutely, atomic bomb cinema is continuing, and it's taking on. It's one of the beauties of the apocalyptic imagination is that it's extremely plastic. It adapts other genres, it draws from other sources, and it adapts to its in changing environment. It's a medium for encouraging us to survive and self-actualize, to spiritually grow in oppressive times. And so atomic bomb cinema, I think, will continue to be with us as long as there's atomic bombs.
So you're defining it fairly broadly here. Do you think there will be a point at which the atomic bomb will no longer play a part of this and we'll move on to a different vehicle or tool for expressing this belief in the end times or?
Oh, okay. Atomic bomb cinema will end, I assume, when nuclear weapons are no longer an issue in our world. They might continue then as a metaphor for other issues, what Hitchcock might call a MacGuffin. They will continue that way as much as we use the Civil War and to talk about our times, or science fiction to talk about our times. The apocalyptic imagination, I see no point at which it will end. It's a part of us. It has been for a millennia, for several millennia, and will continue to be a useful genre, a useful narrative structure for understanding our changing times.
Thank you. Very good. You've been listening to Jerome Shapiro, resident cinema studies scholar on the faculty at Hiroshima University in Japan. This ain't no